The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Book 2, Chapter 4, Part 3. Take another rationalistic explanation of the rise of Christendom. It is common enough to find another critic saying, Christianity did not really rise at all. That is, it did not merely rise from below, it was imposed from above. It is an example of the power of the executive, especially in despotic states. The empire was really an empire, that is, it was really ruled by the emperor. One of the emperors happened to become a Christian. He might just as well have become a Mithraist, or a Jew, or a fire-worshipper. It was common in the decline of the empire for eminent and educated people to adopt these eccentric Eastern cults. But when he adopted it, it became the official religion of the Roman Empire, and when it became the official religion of the Roman Empire, it became as strong, as universal, and as invincible as the Roman Empire. It has only remained in the world as a relic of that empire, or, as many have put it, it is but the ghost of Caesar still hovering over Rome. This is a very ordinary line taken in the criticism of orthodoxy, to say that it was only officialism that ever made it orthodoxy. And here again, we can call on the heretics to refute it. The whole great history of the Arian heresy might have been invented to explode this idea. It is a very interesting history, often repeated in this connection. And the upshot of it is that in so far as there ever was a merely official religion, it actually died because it was a merely an official religion. And what destroyed it was the real religion. Arius advanced a version of Christianity which moved more or less vaguely in the direction of what we should call Unitarianism, though it was not the same, for it gave to Christ a curious intermediary position between the divine and human. The point is that it seemed to many more reasonable and less fanatical, and among these were many of the educated class, in a sort of reaction against the first romance of conversion. Arians were a sort of moderates and a sort of modernists, and it was felt that after the first squabbles, this was the final form of rationalized religion into which civilization might well settle down. It was accepted by Divus Caesar himself, and became the official orthodoxy. The generals and military princes, drawn from the new barbarian powers of the north, full of the future, supported it strongly. But the sequel is still more important. Exactly as a modern man might pass through Unitarianism to complete agnosticism, so the greatest of the Arian emperors ultimately shed the last and thinnest pretense of Christianity. He abandoned even Arius and returned to Apollo. He was a Caesar of the Caesars, a soldier, a scholar, a man of large ambitions and ideals, another of the philosopher kings. It seemed to him as if at his signal the sun rose again. The oracles began to speak like birds beginning to sing at dawn. Paganism was itself again. The gods returned. It seemed the end of that strange interlude of an alien superstition. And indeed it was the end of it, so far as there was a mere interlude of mere superstition. It was the end of it, in so far as it was the fad of an emperor or the fashion of a generation. If there really was something that began with Constantine, then it ended with Julian. But there was something that did not end. There had arisen in that hour of history, defiant above the democratic tumult of the councils of the church, Athanasius against the world. We may pause upon the point at issue, because it is relevant to the whole of this religious history, and the modern world seems to miss the point of it. We might put it this way. If there is one question which the enlightened and liberal have the habit of deriding and holding up as a dreadful example of barren dogma and senseless sectarian strife, it is this Athanasian question of the co-eternity of the divine Son. On the other hand, if there is one thing that the same liberals always offer us as a piece of pure and simple Christianity, untroubled by doctrinal disputes, it is the single sentence, God is love. Yet the two statements are almost identical. At least one is very nearly nonsense without the other. The barren dogma is only the logical way of stating the beautiful sentiment. For if there be a being without beginning, existing before all things, was he loving when there was nothing to be loved? If through that unthinkable eternity he is lonely, what is the meaning of saying he is love? The only justification of such a mystery is the mystical conception that in his own nature there was something analogous to self-expression, something of what begets and beholds what it has begotten. Without some such idea, it is really illogical to complicate the ultimate essence of deity with an idea like love. If the moderns really want a simple religion of love, they must look for it in the Athanasian Creed. The truth is that the trumpet of true Christianity, the challenge of the charities and simplicities of Bethlehem or Christmas Day, never rang out more arrestingly and unmistakably. The truth is that the trumpet of true Christianity, the challenge of the charities and simplicities of Bethlehem or Christmas Day, never rang out more arrestingly and unmistakably than in the defiance of Athanasius to the cold compromise of the Arians. It was emphatically he who really was fighting for a God of love against a God of colorless and remote cosmic control, the God of the Stoics and the Agnostics. It was emphatically he who was fighting for the Holy Child against the gray deity of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. He was fighting for that very balance of beautiful interdependence and intimacy in the very Trinity of the divine nature that draws our hearts to the Trinity of the Holy Family. His dogma, if the phrase be not misunderstood, turns even God into a holy family. That this purely Christian dogma actually for a second time rebelled against the empire, and actually for a second time refounded the church in spite of the empire, is itself a proof that there was something positive and personal working in the world, other than whatever official faith the empire chose to adopt. This power utterly destroyed the official faith that the empire did adopt. It went on its own way, as it is going on its own way still. There are any number of other examples in which is repeated precisely the same process we have reviewed in the case of the Manichaean and the Arian. A few centuries afterwards, for instance, the Church had to maintain the same Trinity, which is simply the logical side of love, against another appearance of the isolated and simplified deity in the religion of Islam. Yet there are some who cannot see what the Crusaders were fighting for, and some even who talk as if Christianity had never been anything but a form of what they call Hebraism, coming in with the decay of Hellenism. These people must certainly be very much puzzled by the war between the Crescent and the Cross. If Christianity had never been anything but a simpler morality sweeping away polytheism, there is no reason why Christendom should not have been swept into Islam. The truth is that Islam itself was a barbaric reaction against that very humane complexity that is really a Christian character. That idea of balance in the deity, as of balance in the family, that makes that creed a sort of sanity, and that sanity the soul of civilization. And that is why the church is, from the very first, a thing holding its own position and point of view, quite apart from the accidents and anarchies of its age. That is why it deals blows impartially right and left at the pessimism of the Manichaean or the optimism of the Pelagian. It was not a Manichaean movement because it was not a movement at all. It was not an official fashion because it was not a fashion at all. It was something that could coincide with movements and fashions, could control them, and could survive them. So might rise from their graves the great heresiarchs to confound their comrades of today. There is nothing that the critics now affirm that we cannot call on these great witnesses to deny. The modern critic will say lightly enough that Christianity was but a reaction into asceticism and anti-natural spirituality, a dance of fakirs furious against life and love. But Manes, the great mystic, will answer them from his secret throne and cry, "These Christians have no right to be called spiritual. These Christians have no title to be called ascetics. They who compromised with the curse of life and all the filth of the family. Through them the earth is still foul with fruit and harvest and polluted with population. Theirs was no movement against nature, or my children would have carried it to triumph. But these fools renewed the world when I would have ended it with a gesture." And another critic will write that the church was but the shadow of the empire, the fad of a chance emperor, and that it remains in Europe only as the ghost of the power of Rome. And Arius the deacon will answer out of the darkness of oblivion, "No, indeed, or the world would have followed my more reasonable religion. For mine went down before demagogues and men defying Caesar, and around my champion was the purple cloak, and mine was the glory of the eagles. It was not for lack of these things that I failed." And yet a third modern will maintain that the creed spread only as a sort of panic of hellfire, men everywhere attempting impossible things in fleeing from incredible vengeance, a nightmare of imaginary remorse. And such an explanation will satisfy many who see something dreadful in the doctrine of orthodoxy. And then there will go up against it the terrible voice of Tertullian, saying, "And why then was I cast out? And why did soft hearts and heads decide against me when I proclaimed the perdition of all sinners? And what was this power that thwarted me when I threatened all backsliders with hell? For none ever went up that hard road so far as I, and mine was the credo quia impossibile." Then there is the fourth suggestion, that there was something of the Semitic secret society in the whole matter, that it was a new invasion of the nomad spirit, shaking a kindlier and more comfortable paganism, its cities and its household gods, whereby the jealous monotheistic races could, after all, establish their jealous god. And Mahomet shall answer out of the whirlwind, the red whirlwind of the desert, "Who ever served the jealousy of God as I did, or left him more lonely in the sky? Who ever paid more honor to Moses and Abraham, or won more victories over idols and the images of paganism? And what was this thing that thrust me back with the energy of a thing alive, whose fanaticism could drive me from Sicily and tear up my deep roots out of the rock of Spain? What faith was theirs who thronged in thousands of every class and country, crying out that my ruin was the will of God? And what hurled great Godfrey as from a catapult over the wall of Jerusalem? And what brought great Sobieski like a thunderbolt to the gates of Vienna? I think there was more than you fancy in the religion that has so matched itself with mine. Those who would suggest that the faith was a fanaticism are doomed to an eternal perplexity. In their account, it is bound to appear as fanatical for nothing, and fanatical against everything. It is ascetical, and at war with ascetics, Roman, and in revolt against Rome, monotheistic, and fighting furiously against monotheism, harsh in its condemnation of harshness, a riddle not to be explained even as unreason. And what sort of unreason is it that seems reasonable to millions of educated Europeans through all the revolutions of some 1600 years? People are not amused with a puzzle or a paradox or a mere muddle in the mind for all that time. I know of no explanation except that such a thing is not unreason, but reason. That if it is fanatical, it is fanatical for reason, and fanatical against all the unreasonable things. That is the only explanation I can find of a thing from the first so detached and so confident, condemning things that looked so like itself, refusing help from powers that seemed so essential to its existence, sharing on its human side all the passions of the age, yet always at the supreme moment, suddenly rising superior to them, never saying exactly what it was expected to say, and never needing to unsay what it had said. I can find no explanation, except that, like Pallas from the brain of Jove, it had indeed come forth out of the mind of God, mature and mighty, and armed for judgment and for war. End of chapter 4 of book 2.